Before Major Dundee was released in 1965, Sam Peckinpah, its director, was kicked off the project, and he asked that his name be removed from the credits. When it was released, with 20 to 50 minutes cut out of what he had planned, and with a score that he detested, the critics all declared Major Dundee a major dud. But 40 years later, after a lot of detective and technical work, the film is being re-released with additional footage and a new score. And here to speak with us about this newer so-called extended version of the film is Grover Crisp, Vice President of Asset Management and Film Restoration for Sony Pictures Entertainment, and Christopher Caliendo, the composer of the new score. And I want to thank you both so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
And Let's begin with you, Grover. Why do you call this an extended version rather than a director's cut?
Well, we actually debated what to call it. We needed to call it a little something to make sure that it was identified as not the original version. We can't call it a director's cut. Obviously, the director's not around, and he can't sanction this version of the film.
But you have some idea of what he would have hoped for, don't you?
We do, of course, from his correspondence and letters and friends and co-workers and everything, in terms of what he intended. And this version, while it's not a director's cut, and certainly we're not claiming it's the version he always intended it to be or anything like that, we think that it is, we hope that it's taken as something that's approaching what he had in mind.
Christopher, why did he hate the score so much?
Apparently, the score did not fulfill the psychology, the metaphysics of the subject matter, the characters. There was also an unusual use of instrumentation that didn't necessarily qualify as endemic to either the cultures involved, or such as the Indian music, which was, I understand, viewed very, very with vitriolic enmity.
If I can say
composed
something
by Daniel Amphitheatrov. Yeah, he actually did a lot of films, didn't he?
He did quite a few.
A lot of Westerns.
This was actually the last major feature film that he composed. I would say that it's not a bad score, the original score. It's a matter of whether or not it was appropriate to what the director had in mind.
And then it starts off with a theme song sung by Mitch Miller and the Sing-Along Gang, and that automatically gets audiences laughing, I think, even in 1965.
Well, partly because it's a kind of an upbeat tune played over the images of slaughtered people.
Hmm. Well,
so you can kind of draw your own conclusions as to whether
that
it was appropriate.
Now, where was Peckinpah in, how was he regarded at the time? He had already directed Ride the High Country, which many people consider a great film.
And Deadly Companions, but he'd also had his formative years, of course, in television with some of the Western series that he was involved in, like The Westerner and Track Down.
And he was, his mentor had been Don Siegel?
Yes.
Well, isn't that weird? Because the two prominent directors, Sam Peckinpah, a maximalist, and Clint Eastwood, a minimalist, both cite Don Siegel as their mentor.
Yes. Yes.
But what this would suggest is he was not yet at the point where he could tell a studio what he wanted and get away with it.
No, not at all.
He wasn't
not
established enough.
No. And in fact, this was, of course, his first big studio production. And unfortunately, they kind of went into it without a finished script, and never really did finish the script.
And this was a time when Columbia Pictures was also going through some turmoil?
Well, I don't know that I would describe it as that. I think
there was a corporate shakeup there.
Yeah, but then again, that happens every few years, something like that happens. So that's not too unusual.
But then the budget was cut?
Budget was cut just before it went into production, which seriously affected the completion of the screenplay, of course, because they had to then revise the scope of the production itself.
And then Peckinpah had a reputation for not getting along with people anyway, so there was probably a big
reputation
ego clash.
For being a difficult director. Yes.
Is there also a problem with the script to this, because it is not a typical Western? This is in that period where Westerns are going from just a straightforward hero at the center to more complicated,
really
difficult
people. It really is, especially if you look at it in the context of his career, or if you look at it in the context of the development of Westerns. It's kind of a transition transitional film in that regard. It's not quite, like you say, the traditional Western hero up to and including things like The Magnificent Seven, but it's also not quite like The Wild Bunch and everything that followed The Wild Bunch.
Well, Charlton Heston plays this troubled Major Dundee, a man who has had problems in the past in his career, and then he makes some decisions that he shouldn't have made, and yet he's still the hero, so it becomes a kind of a complicated...
Well, he's definitely a flawed hero, that's for sure, and willing to sacrifice anyone and anything for his own personal glory, of course. That's really what this whole mission that he's on in the film is about.
Charlton Heston was obviously committed. He decided to forego some of his salary to extend shooting schedule.
Yeah, that was the decision made at the time.
This film is being called a film maudit, a picture that is usually reviled upon its release. Film critic Jim Hoberman describes it as a film that is ripped from its director's womb and mutilated by its studio, misunderstood or reviled on release. It proves ruinous at the box office. Is this a classic case?
That was all true, yes.
It
was meant to be a big roadshow production that year, and of course it with the budget being cut, that kind of went away. That aspect of it went away, and then, of course, it got bad reviews.
Well, do you think that with the score changed and with how many minutes, 12 minutes added?
There are 12 minutes that have been put back in, and that's actually the most that we can do at this point. There is no additional footage that can be found. But they are pretty much key scenes, and they are in the film, back in the film, exactly where they were supposed to be from Peckinpah's shooting script as well.
Well, we'll come back to how those scenes were discovered, but let's get you into this, Chris. How were you brought into this project?
I received a call from Grover late November. He had been working on the film for a while at that point, but suddenly had decided that perhaps we could create an opportunity to have a new score put on the film. So it was early December where the go-ahead was given, and I was very grateful to have the opportunity to score the picture. So December 10th at 1:30, I started the first note, and on January 10th at 2:14 in the morning, I wrote the last note.
Wow, that's very, very quick, isn't it? But you did have the advantage of having the complete film in front of you. So many, many scores are written while the film is still being worked on, and that makes it more difficult to know how it's finally going to turn out. Mm-hmm. But what did you think when you heard the original score? Boy, what a disaster, or this is okay, but it needs a little fixing up?
Well, naturally, the consequence. I didn't necessarily think it was a disaster at all, but I was given a commission to see if we could possibly improve the film. And my initial reaction, because of the limited amount of time, was to deal with the internal aspects of the film rather than the external aspects. I thought we could improve perhaps upon the psychology of the individuals, the various characters.
But you were concerned, I'm sure, not to make it sound like a more contemporary score. You had to write this as though it had been written in 1969.
Yeah, my approach to music making is very intuitive. The blessing that I had from Grover was when he sent the three cassettes blank, and I had a chance to look at the picture raw without music. And here's where a composer finally can enter into their own psyche and hear a fresh score. And what came into my mind very quickly were those Peckinpah themes about man and man's nature, war, and the fact that man by nature is warlike. And Heston's demons and obsessions, the Indian music, it became very quickly necessary to capitalize on writing endemic music of the period and music that very much summed up the metaphysics of the film.
I misstated the time. It's 1964. I said 1969 accidentally. So this is when we're just starting to get involved in the Vietnam War. Grover, do you agree with those people who see some parallels, metaphors?
American intervention in a foreign territory?
Because this takes place.
Absolutely.
We go into Mexico. American troops go into Mexico. As American troops went into Cambodia at another time.
Just kind of bore into Mexico, as a matter of fact. It's a completely unauthorized mission that he's on. And of course, if you want to draw the parallel even further, the French are occupying Mexico, just as they were in Vietnam. And, of course, he winds up clashing with the French, which is not intentional at all. And there are definitely parallels there.
This whole thing goes back to 1991, doesn't it, when somebody found some footage?
Well, we were doing some fairly routine lab work, actually, at the time, and we pulled in a set of film elements that are called separation masters, and these are actually film elements that are made to protect the original negative. And as it turned out, we discovered that they 10 of the 16 reels were longer than the original cut. And so we took a look at those and realized that there was additional footage, additional scenes in it, and immediately started looking to see if we could find audio to match that, which we could not find, which rendered that additional footage somewhat useless. Interesting, of course, but not much that we could do with it. So yes, that was 1991. Around the mid-90s, we came up with some additional outtakes that we started looking at to see if there was any more footage, and that proved not to be the case in that regard. So we kind of put it on hold again, still couldn't find any audio. And but during the period of the late 90s up until a few years ago, Sony Pictures was consolidating all of our worldwide storage, and we moved around over a million different items and consolidated. And sure enough, when we went back to look at the film again about 2 years ago, here was one audio element that didn't seem quite to match everything else, and of course it matched this version perfectly.
And then
which means, by the way, that and this was most likely the original preview version, and it was at one time considered a final version. It just was never released.
So this might not have been Sam Peckinpah's final cut
either,
but it does fill in a lot
of stories.
This is
definitely not Sam Peckinpah's final cut, because he was never allowed a cut. On the other hand, the way the film was shot and scripted, there's only one way you could really put those scenes together. And fortunately, after the film was taken away from him, it wasn't re-edited so much as just shortened. A lot of films, of course, when they do shorten them, they completely move around scenes and things like that. And this was not the case. So that lends a bit more authenticity, I think, to this version.
Usually when you go back to that old material, you discover there's been a lot of deterioration. We also have different standards on sound. So did you have a lot of work to do?
There was a bit of that. There was some damage in the original negative, and we were able to pretty much cover everything in terms of replacement footage. I think the film, you know, for a 40-year-old film, it's a great-looking film right now, and looks especially good on the film forum screen. I just looked at it this morning. But
it'll be running at the film forum starting today for 12 nights until April 19th.
Right. In terms of the audio, of course, up until, as Christopher mentioned, November, there was no thought whatsoever to replace the score. We had already restored and preserved the original soundtrack, which I must point out remains. We've not gotten rid of it. And in fact, when it comes out on the DVD, both soundtracks will be on there, so people can actually compare the two.
Because that does answer the complaint of one reviewer who said that this sets a terrible precedent, you've replaced the original score, even though everyone agrees the original score was not what Sam Peckinpah wanted or what some of us might consider adequate.
Well, we realized that this would be certainly the most controversial aspect of this going in, and it was not a decision made lightly. But I must say, already having known that we can provide the original soundtrack on prints, on DVD, and it absolutely will be available, this new version, and the score only applies to this extended version, by the way, the long version, is really, in a lot of ways, our best idea of what it maybe could have been if Peckinpah had been allowed to complete it. And we consulted the Peckinpah scholars on how he worked with composers on his later films, because there's a clear path there that you can trace as to how he approached music. And we took that approach with this.
Well, when we see silent films with an added score, we're not seeing what people would have seen in the movie theaters then anyway. This doesn't bother me as much as long as the original is retained. We have very little time. Do we see the early stages of the Wild Bunch in this movie?
Absolutely. In fact, in a lot of ways, the Wild Bunch is his version, remake of Major Dundee.
Major Dundee is being shown at the Film Forum, and my two guests will be there tonight for the 8 o'clock show to talk with you. I want to thank you both so much for being with us, Grover Crisp, Vice President of Asset Management and Film Restoration for Sony Pictures, and Christopher Caliendo, who wrote the new score. What a pleasure.
Yeah. Thanks for having us.
Thank you.